The following Dharma talk was given by Jody Hojin Kimmel at the Zen Center of New York City, Fire Lotus Temple. Hojin Sensei is the abbot of the Zen Center and head priest at Zen Mountain Monastery.
Good morning, Brooklyn. Just taking in, wow, so nice. It's great to have you all here this morning. This is called The Source of Milk by Rumi. Don't look for it outside yourself. You are the source of milk. Don't milk others. There is a milk fountain inside you. Don't walk around with an empty bucket. You have a channel into the ocean, and yet you ask for water from a little pool. Beg for that love expansion. Meditate on that. You have to put aside your lactose intolerance and your vegan for a moment and just look at this primal source that Rumi's pointing to, that we are the source of milk, of nourishment. And usually I don't give a talk a title, I still understand, but I had a title for this one, and it's called The Unshakable Milkshake at the Shake Shack. And that might become a little more explained as we go along. Because we were had a vigil. This is the commemoration, this December 8th, of Buddha's enlightenment, 26 and some hundred years ago. And here we are practicing the path the Buddha laid out for true liberation here in Brooklyn. Amazing when you think about it. And, you know, when I came into practice, Buddha, I didn't know the Buddha. Who's the Buddha, right? And then Dharma, wasn't quite sure what a Dharma was. Sangha, as far as community, that was an entry point. Like the community was really a place I was like, wow, like people coming together for this sort of way of being and taking care and working through some of our attachments and even all that was kind of new. So I wanted to take this opportunity, as I usually do, to talk about the Buddha and what the Buddha taught and his resolve, which I find fascinating now, having sat for many years and seeing suffering in so many different forms. Maybe at first we're not even aware of our own. Some of us may be very aware of our own suffering and the fact of it, just the fact of it. But his resolve to answer that question that drove him, why do we suffer? Why do we suffer? Why, as a human being, do we suffer? Why does life suffer? And that on this one day, we have this opportunity to acknowledge and celebrate the possibility of not spinning. Not spinning with confusion, reactivity, separation, that this day is dedicated to bringing that up. And celebrating that amidst that, a profound stillness is possible. We can be still. And if you're new, you might think like, no, sorry, not me. I thought that at first. I don't know if I can be still. I don't know what's, there was stillness in me. I could feel it in a pot on the potter's wheel. That's where I felt I could feel contact, a real stillness, nature. Sitting in nature, but to really be being stillness itself. Don't look for it outside yourself. Our liberation can't be outsourced. Yet we do. We often look outside, right, for to be validated, comforted, spiritual fulfillment. Buddha's last words were, be a lamp unto yourself. Be a lamp unto yourself. Don't look for refuge in outer authorities, but rely on our direct seeing, your own direct seeing, what you experience through your body and mind. He says the Dharma doesn't fix us because there's nothing to fix, but we can see causes and conditions that make us suffer. And if we create it, we can uncreate it. It's a creative process. So what we create, we can uncreate. Buddha wanted us to see this. So he was a destroyer of ignorance to open our Buddha mind, our capacity. And I remember my first beginning instruction with Shugen Roshi when he was a senior monk. And I remember he said, no one can give you anything. And that really landed deep. And part of me was going like, shucks. Really? Like, I want to be saved. I want to be saved. But he said, no one can give you anything. People can help, for sure. But it's, he said, this is going to be based on your own direct experience. So we have everything we need to undertake the journey, he said. Only our willingness to participate, to decide over and over again, not to jump away when it gets uncomfortable. Because just look at if you just did a period of Zazen, whether you've been sitting for 10, 20, 30 years or you walked in today, it gets uncomfortable. There will be periods of discomfort, maybe constant, where we don't know what's happening. But if we're willing, ability is given. Ability is given. So who was Buddha? We wouldn't be sitting here without that great love for humanity. He could have just walked off. I got what I needed. I solved it. And he could have just, and he was faced with that decision, apparently. The story goes, we have stories on papyrus. But a person passed him by, so struck by what was radiating from this being. Like we sometimes can feel that from people, their energy, right, given off. We just, certain people make us feel very calm. Sometimes we are churned up, we're agitated. But they felt this peacefulness radiating. And they said, what are you? A celestial being? A god? A magician? A wizard? Who are you? And Buddha said no to all of those labels. And he said, I'm awake. Meaning awakened to the ignorance of suffering. It's called dukkha of the ordinary world. So Buddha wasn't a god, a deity, to be worshipped, a great physician, that's who he was. A tour guide, that's who he was. Awake. My teacher, Daito Roshi, used to say, after a long time of practice, if somebody said, hey, Buddha never existed, there was never a Buddha, it said it wouldn't matter. It wouldn't matter. Because what is transmitted is something that's within all of us. Awake. He offered something that we could find reliable, a true refuge, a refuge of sanity. I had one teacher that always said, we should value being insane. It means we're insanity. Different turn on that. Because everyone went like, really? And said, yes, your insanity. We should value being insanity. again, are we prepared to see? You know, because it said it's not for the faint of heart to practice all that we need to encounter. And we say, yeah, I want to be free. I want to see what's true. And then we start to see, and we're like, no, not that. Yeah, when we start to get into the dark recesses of our mind and, attachments, just unhelpful habits, all that juicy stuff that we have that sometimes serves in one way and sometimes doesn't serve us very well. And Buddha said we have to give up. And we say, yeah, but no, it's like so hard. We I don't know if we say like it, but we're used to it. It's familiar, right? So Buddha's great love is to inspire us to awaken from our complacency and ignorance. The milk fountain, I don't know, how do you hear the milk fountain? I'll get to that. Don't look outside yourselves. You are the source of milk. There is a milk fountain inside you. Maybe I heard it as like the Buddha nature, the completeness. That's always, that we're always complete, perfect and complete, lacking nothing. An ever-present well of spaciousness, silence, stillness. An oceanic awareness. But sometimes we need a milkshake. And that's Buddhist practice. It's a milkshake. A Shake Shack to uproot. And I was thinking of the poem Buddha wrote when he, you know, realized himself, which was called House Builder. And I see that as the shack, right? He says, seeking but not finding the house builder, I hurried through the round of many births. Painful is birth ever and again. Oh, house builder, you have been seen. You shall not build the house again. Your rafters have been broken up. Your ridgepole is demolished too. My mind has now attained the unformed perfect peace we call nirvana. And reach the end of every sort of craving. He was 35 years old. So perhaps Buddha's most important teaching was the story of his own journey to enlightenment. That's why I think it's worth repeating as a tour map, a guide for our own journey. And also we don't have to go through what he did. You know, he had this question and he tried so many various techniques, including asceticism and abnegation of the body, that we don't have to do that. We don't have to cut that off. And you might be surprised how similar his spiritual journey is to each of ours, though. Why? Well, we each have a life. And if we're asking ourselves questions, there will be a journey. We're building some sort of house and we're wondering, what is this that we've built? What's going on? So the Buddha was born in a royal family. The Shakyan tribe, which is now Nepal, in what is now Nepal. And he had the epitome of what might be called privilege at that time. Maybe the equivalent of being into a billionaire's home, a billionaire's family, all the luxury and pleasures that one could want. So you have to imagine that. And he's behind these, in a palace, behind these palace walls, with all of this at his beckon and call. And unconscious privilege definitely can shield us not only from suffering, but also from the knowledge of suffering. The God realm is a painful realm. Is a very painful realm. It's not going to last. Yet we may know, no matter how good our life is, how insulated, we'll still have to acknowledge the realities of illness, old age, and death. Although there are some people now that are trying to bypass that with various things. Very interesting. And his mother was Maya Deva. We chanted her name this morning. And she died 7 days after the Buddha's birth. And Mahapajapati, who was on that altar, Buddha's Suddhodana, his father had two wives. Maya was his first wife, and Mahapajapati was his second wife, her sister. She raised the Buddha, gave the Buddha her milk. There we are again, another milkshake. Life-giving energy. And his parents kept him sequestered. Because when you're sequestered, maybe they thought he would have no reason to ask any big questions. Everything would just be right there in this little world of his. And they had plans that he would be the next king. But of course, an astrologer was brought in when he was born. He said, I think your plans may not be true. There's another possibility here that this little child is going to be a great spiritual leader. And they were like, whoa, no. We need a king. We don't need that. So they protected him. And in his adolescence, in his 20s, a life of constant pleasure, there was a thorn. There was a thorn. He began to feel like a prisoner in his own home. Do we feel like that sometimes? Something holding us back, something that's, we have bigger questions. We're wondering what's outside this setup here. He kept thinking something was missing that was gnawing at him. And he figured out he wasn't being allowed to leave the palace grounds. He didn't know. Isn't that interesting? I always feel like there were things I remember later in life, like more recently, finding out things in my own family that was like, not where we go. And I never understood that was happening. You know, we find out things that were happening because that's the only thing we know. And then we're like, you think that's everywhere, but then you start seeing like, no, it's not. There's other things, other ways to live. So he talked his attendant into slipping him out to the side, the palace gate, to sneak out. Now, I don't think you had to sneak out this morning. To come to the temple. Does anybody have to sneak out? Maybe you did. Where are you going? Can't tell you. I'm going to a temple to practice. But he did. He had to sneak out. And there's a stele in the museum which shows that time with the attendant had the horses ready and they pick, everyone's sleeping and they pick the horses up and they're so they don't go clip-clop, clip-clop, and they get out. So they snuck out, and then he encountered what we call the four messengers. So we see this sickness and disease. Imagine you've never seen that, how shocking that could be when you see that. He saw an old, frail person, bent, skin sagging, hair falling out. He said to his attendant, "We get old? Am I going to get old?" Attendant's like, uh-huh. He was revolted. He saw a dead body. Everyone dies? He asked his attendant. Yeah. Nobody gets out alive. And then he saw a wandering spiritual seeker, someone that seemed to walk in peace, equanimity. What's this? If all this is here, how come this person's like this? It was a, if you can imagine the terrible, terrible shock of seeing all these things. I still feel that when I look around sometimes. Sometimes we can get numb to what's around us. And part of my practice is to not do that, to keep seeing it, keep feeling it, keep working with it, with all beings. So he came back in and he proceeded, life rolled on. He had all that in him now. And then he had a marriage arranged. Getting married. Set up. Young wealthy woman, Yasodhara, also became his student. They had a son very shortly afterwards named Rahula, which is translated as fetter. Interesting name for a child. And so now he's married with a child. And then he has the experience that he saw directly within his own body and mind of these messengers. And he started sinking deep, deeper and deeper. And then this great doubt, this spiritual fire arose. Why do we suffer? And can we be free of it? I need to find out. And you know, there's practices at the time that he was involved in, so he knew about, you know, spiritual practice and yoga. He was a highly developed yogi. So he snuck out again without not being chorted by Mara, that part of us that says, go back, you're going to fail. Don't do it. But he went. And I remember that I watched my parents, I had already entered the monastery and the film The Little Buddha came out, if you've ever seen that. And I thought, okay, this is something, maybe I could do this with my folks and they'll get a little broader picture of what I'm doing. It's now in the mainstream, right? The Little Buddha came out. It was done very well. And then at the end, my dad said, well, that wasn't very nice. He left his wife and kid. And I was like, yeah, I hear you, Dad. I hear you. Yeah. And I said, well, was it a selfish thing that he did? Was it selfish? Like maybe that was very altruistic. Like it felt like maybe he was wanting this answer not just for himself, but for his family, for his child, for everyone. He knew that if he could see that, that would be really helpful. So that was one stage there of his journey. And next part was seeking the answer. So he left the palace, he went to the forest, tried many spiritual methods of his day, and some of us may be going around doing this path, trying different things. There's so many things to try. And, you know, I remember Path with a Heart, Jack Kornfield said, yeah, you can dig a lot of small holes, but eventually you got to dig a deep hole. You got to settle into something and dig a deep hole, because each path will give you something. But you got to meet those places that make you feel uncomfortable, make you want to stop and turn away over and over and over. And if we keep moving to a new thing because we're uncomfortable, then we'll just stay on the top there. But he exhausted some of these methods of concentration, of tantra, and he excelled with all his teachers, and they asked him to become a teacher, and he refused the invitation How many of us would do that? I want you to be this teacher in this path. And it's like, no, I can't, because those states were blissful. But then he found himself crashing back down to earth, still suffering. So he had another bright idea. I'll break the identification with my body with self-mortification, starving his body to the extreme renunciation of taking any kind of nourishment. Said he practiced that for 6 years. Thank God we don't have to do this. And he was very close to starving, totally committed still to waking up from the delusion of his attachments, aversions, and identifications with what caused suffering. How was that going? Not so good. Not so good. He was losing it. Try as he might to deny, purify, change, improve, transcend himself, his practice did not deliver an end to suffering. Still there. And then there was a very interesting development. He turned away from the path of self-torture and excessive denial. And this reflection arose from when he was a child. You may know the story where his parents were plowing a field and they were churning over insects and it was hard for him to see. So he took a seat under a tree, a rose apple tree. He's 8 years old, 8 or 9. And some of us may have experienced this where we got very still and quiet and peaceful. No striving, very natural. And he remembered that and he said, that's what I need to do. So this combination of having a path and practicing, and then how do we release that striving and that idea of who we need to be in it, and just appreciate and sit into that restfulness. It's not easy, because so much of our life is set up for these goals and fulfillments, and we're on that track. And so to sit into ourself, to just be with ourself, don't walk around with an empty bucket. You have a channel into the ocean. Beg for that love expansion to sit in such a way. But even though he was, so that was so pure and simple, relaxed, and he knew that didn't involve crushing the body or anything like that. Yet he still waged a battle against himself. We'll still battle. We'll still fight it. But he knew he needed balance. And he was in doubt about this asceticism. So it was a shake-up, a milkshake to his homies, the people he was with, because they accused him and bullied him for selling out. They taunted him. They insulted him. So he said, I just got to go. I'm going by the river to think about this. I'm just going to go sit by the river and listen and meditate as best I could. He could barely walk at this point. He could barely walk. And it said one day, a young woman named Sujata was on her way to making offerings to a local god, which is was in a particular tree because she wanted to have a son. And she was going to make offerings. She had just come from the market and had fresh milk. And she found Gautama close to death, next to a small stream, almost just like passing out, going in and out of passing out. And she got down to the ground and she fed him a bowl of porridge, rice milk, and he took it. He took it in. He accepted it. And then we can imagine maybe she kept coming back and nourishing him, giving him more food, maybe sheltered him from the elements. Maybe she applied some ointments and gave him medicine. We don't know. Maybe a fresh set of robes. He hardly had clothes on. So this is Avalokiteshvara showing up for a stranger. Just in our passing by, what do we have to give? We may not get down on the ground and offer food. We might. We might offer something that will help. We may just say something in our mind as we pass. Make contact. Just like feel like I see you. That's a lot. She didn't start asking him questions. Hey, why are you like this? What got you here? No, she didn't start giving him theories about what he needed. Complicated advice, you know, if you only did this, if you did. No, she fell to the ground and offered presence, loving care. And that changed throughout his life. He remembered that moment, which was part of his teaching on the spiritual path for us, to be in presence with each other. And that he saw the utter uselessness of the path of pain he committed to. So he gained help, and then he cast his milk bowl into the river, and he said, if I am to fully awaken, may this bowl float upstream. Guess what? The bowl floated upstream. And he continued to nourish himself back to health. He was strong enough to sit down on the earth. And he went and he found the Bodhi tree. He sat down beneath it. And just in that very simple, pure way, nourishing himself, just sat down with this resolve to end suffering. And then, of course, Mara shows up. Mara in the tradition, in the Buddhist tradition, personifies negative emotions. There we are with our resolve. I want to wake up, come to a temple. I want to sit. I'm going to really do this. And then something comes in our mind, negative. What am I doing here? When's lunch? My knees hurt. Why did I come here? I don't see any results when I leave. It's not what I expected. This is boring. We got our top 10, right? Mara. Emotions, when taken personally, that cause us suffering. Obscurations. Obstacles is Mara. Death is Mara. That we have to die is Mara. That fact, the fact that the world's unpredictable is Mara. Uncontrollable. This is an uncontrollable place. That's Mara. Mara identifies with the five skandhas, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, as permanent, as lasting. Doesn't want it to go. Lust, fear, jealousy, anger. Just look in a period of zazen, your last one. How many Maras showed up? That person's doing it better than me. Mara. Hi, Mara. That's what the Buddha said. Eventually, I know your name. I know your name. Anything that causes us to turn against ourself that we know may be not helpful or healing. So we've all met Mara. Mara hates practice. With Mara, we're afraid that we'll actually see through our illusions. We like them. So Mara loves a good fight. And Mara says to Buddha, arise, get up from your seat. It doesn't belong to you, it belongs to me. Don't sit there. Sound familiar? Just forget about it. Yet Mara is a necessary part of the equation. We can't have a Buddha mind without a Mara mind. So Mara mind is just one episode we can understand in a process that continues each moment to moment to moment. And Buddha is Buddha because in each moment we're challenged to go against that stream of Mara and choose an awakened life. So Buddha nature stands for an open perspective. Stephen Batchelor says, really free to respond to the call of others. He says, in our Mara nature, it's our fixed positions that prompt us to react. He said, if we hold a perspective, it allows the possibility of pursuing a path into the unknown. If we hold a position, that ensures we'll never stray from what we've already staked out, our territory. And Robert Thurman says, Maras are said to be bodhisattvas, dwelling in inconceivable liberation, playing the devil, as it were, to develop living beings. That's a nice way to look at it. Like when our mind does that, oh, we have a little bodhisattva there developing us with our negativity. So we can develop, because apart our Buddha nature's there and knows it's not true. It's not true. Buddha is Buddha because in each moment we're challenged to go against the stream. It said that Mara was firing arrows and Buddha turned them into flowers. Mara pointed to the place where he sat, the Buddha. Who witnesses your right to the seat of enlightenment? And the Buddha reaches a finger to the earth and says, this is my witness. This is my witness. I call earth as my witness. The great love met. Let's see how we're doing. Okay. So, beg for that expansion. And Buddha gave us the Eightfold Path. Thank God Buddha was a dreamer. And he decided to teach us the Four Noble Truths about suffering. And that came from a succession of dreams sitting among the trees in the forest where he decided to teach. So let me just review them. And this was the great relief that I heard in beginning instruction. There is suffering. I was like, wow, somebody just said it so plain. There is suffering. Yeah. Dukkha in Sanskrit. It says, this first truth brings awareness what is universal, that we will all suffer in some way. The second is the cause for suffering, samudaya, the arising, addresses the origin, the roots, the nature, the creation or arising of suffering. And we're invited as practitioners to explore our suffering so that we can touch the root of it. And the root takes the form of what we call clinging, desires, ideas, expectations. That's how we know. Attachment to who we think we are in this life. And then there's the cessation of suffering, nirodha, to end suffering. We can put an end to it, he said. After becoming aware of the root, seeing these clinging and the desire, clinging to desires, ones that are unhelpful, that is, expectations, we can see it. Beware of, we can encourage in the practice to stop doing the things that make us suffer. Tall order, but we can uncreate it. How do you do that stop part? How do we do that stop part? Well, this is what we're in training for, training the mind. How do we stop? Just feel it without adding to it. You know, when Avalokiteshvara was, you know, no fear, we have to just tremble without the story of tremble. Just tremble. It's different. It's liberating to just tremble with just trembling. And then the path of the Eightfold Path, Magga, the path. Right view or understanding, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. We can say complete in the place of right. The entire path is right, sama. Every aspect of one's whole path is sama. Okay. Well, that's the unshakable milk shake at the Shake Shack. I'll read his poem once more. Don't look for it outside yourself. You are the source of milk. Don't milk others. There is a milk fountain inside you. Don't walk around with an empty bucket. You have a channel into the ocean, and yet you ask for water from a little pool. Beg for that love expansion. Meditate on this. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about the Zen Center of New York City's programs, retreats, and residency, or to make a donation, please visit our website, zcnyc.org.